we concluded with the definition of Baruch Ata. We really didn't have the time to take it back to the practical implementation in this bracha of Ahavas Olam of eternal love. So I wanted to just spend a few minutes recapping what we discussed last week and how it relates back to the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for Klal Yisrael, which in turn is supposed to evoke the kind of love in V'ahavta, in Krishma, in the response of the Jew. Walking our way through Psuke de Zimra, where we talk about the song which is sung by the rest of creation, reaching out and yearning for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, into the first bracha of Kriya Shema, where we not only talk about the process of creation, but we talk about the yearning of the angels and the fact that despite their yearning, that the angels cannot arrive, and that the Jew, in their yearning for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is not only able to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly, but is able to bring about an illumination of the Almighty into the physicality and the darkness of this world, that in turn calls upon the Jew to reach out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with love. There's no word which is repeated more times in this bracha of Ahavas Olam than the word Ahava itself, than the word in Hebrew of love. Because this, the love that we're talking about, speaks of a uniqueness of a relationship that the Jew has with HaKadosh Baruch Hu over any other creation in existence. Perhaps the most direct or vivid image that needs to come out through this process, and which really the bracha of Ahavas Olam speaks not just to the moment of Shema, but to the entire day of the Jew, is the sense of privilege that a Jew needs to feel in being able to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly. It needs to be understood. This one example comes to mind. I know that we've talked about it before, but it speaks volumes about our attitude. No, I'm not going to have a sandwich now because I'm going to have to bench. It's the language we use. I'm going to have to bench. Where Ahavas Olam says to us, not I'm going to have to bench, but I'm going to have the opportunity to illuminate the world. I'm going to have the opportunity of raising the food that I just ate, by being able to fulfill a positive mitzvah of Birchas HaMazon because I just ate bread. Now, you know, for me, it's a whole different issue. It's the fact that Ovens of Manitowoc is just, you know, very limited in its taste appeal. Right? So that's why we have breadsmith. But if the reason is the 4 or 5 minutes that it's going to take us to say Birchas HaMazon, we've missed the boat. It's exactly the opposite. It's the point that before we eat, we have the opportunity of washing and saying Asher Kidshanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu, that Baruch Ata Hashem, that I have the opportunity of drawing the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the darkness of the world through the mitzvah of Netilas Yadayim. That I have the opportunity of taking the bread that I just ate and illuminating the concealment which exists in that bread and in that food through the fact that I'm able to say these words of Birchas HaMazon over that food. It opens up and illuminates the world in an entire different realm, even higher, even greater than the accomplishment of the angels themselves. That's the message of Ahavas Olam. It's a love affair with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us something which is unique to us that does not exist anywhere else in the realm of existence. And therefore, our attitude towards mitzvahs is, becomes a whole different scheme of things. It's every mitzvah is an added illumination. Every mitzvah is another interaction with this level of love and relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, rather than being something of a burden or a responsibility. It becomes an opportunity of celebrating that love. All right, let's move into the next step. There are two messages that are repeated both in the first bracha of the Birchas Krishma and in the second bracha that obviously are there to draw our attention. If you take a look at page 90, in the middle of the first paragraph, we read, it's exactly four lines down from the top on the left side of the page, last word on the line, Elikei Olam, Berachamecha Harabim Rachem Aleinu, God of the world, with your overflowing compassion, have compassion upon us. If you move to the next page, in the next bracha of Krishma, three lines from the bottom of the page, Avinu of Harachaman Hamirachem, our Father who is a compassionate Father, who has compassion, Rachem Aleinu, take pity upon us. So, not only are we asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have Rachmanis on us, but it's somehow we're asking him to have Rachmanis with his unique Rachmanis. With your compassion, have compassion upon us. There's something that we're calling upon here, which is something, a compassion that we can't arouse. It needs to be Hashem's unique compassion. So this concept is introduced in the Svarim HaKadoshim, and that this compassion is part again of the brachas of Krishna somehow, that this is going to evoke the love of the Jew. So we're going to talk about it on two levels. Level number one is understanding the galus of the neshama. Understanding that the neshama is a sublime chelik elikai, a spark of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a spark of godliness, which unlike anything else in creation which has been severed from its source, the neshama remains connected to its godly source, and it finds itself in a place which is so distant, which is so beyond its lofty comfort zone. It finds itself in what the Svarim HaKadoshim call a neshama which comes me'igra rama, from the top of the building, lebira amikta, to a pit, to a deep pit. And that the neshama, which is made up of godly, lofty material, finds itself in a lowly human body in the company of lowly physical human desire. And during this part of davening, a Jew is supposed to evoke Rachmanis on his neshama, on the neshama which finds itself in such an uncomfortable, foreign setting. But that's not enough. Because ultimately, we can intellectualize about this, and we can sense that the neshama comes from something much more lofty and finds itself in a much baser foreign climate. But we're still working with our minds, and our minds themselves are subject to the very same climate which the neshama is subjected to. And therefore, in as much as we'll study, and as much as we'll ponder, and as much as we'll yearn to grasp the true loftiness of the soul, all of that yearning and all that understanding is still subject to the limitations of our IQ. And our IQ is limited by the climate in which it finds itself. But who has a real picture? Who has a true understanding of the madrega, of the levels of the soul? Who is it that has an understanding of the distinction, of the distance between the source of the soul and where it finds it? It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And only HaKadosh Baruch Hu really understands, therefore, the real Rachmanis of the neshama. The human being, in his limited mind, in his limited intellect, cannot grasp the distance. I gave a mashal, which the mashal itself is very limited. But imagine for the moment that there was the Chavez Beethoven had a father who was a composer and a grandfather who was a composer, and they wrote magnificent symphonies. And then he has a child, and the child is kidnapped by a group of rapsters. And the child never was privy to the unbelievable musical talent which is genetically theirs. And at some point, the child begins to play some type of, I don't even call it music, but some type of beat. And they recognize that there's something here. And off in a distance stands the father and the grandfather and looks at what has become of the talents of this child. And then the child hears a true piece of music. And he begins yearning for whatever form of music he's begun to hear. And he wants to be able to apply himself to this music. And off in the distance stands the father and the grandfather, and they weep because this child doesn't even begin to understand the majesty of the talent which exists within him. So we turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we say, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, we recognize, on some level, we recognize the Rachmanis of our neshama. But we plead with you, Birachamecha HaRabim, you in your compassion, Rachem Aleinu. You, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, are the only one who really knows the majesty of the soul. You are the only one who has any concept of the span of the wide encompass that our neshamas can behold, of the connection that our neshamas can have to you, Rebbeinu Shel Olam. I, in my limited way, I have some smacking. I heard the niggun once. I once heard the tune. But I don't have a sense. I don't have a true sense of what its capacity is, of what its potential is. So we plead with the Rebbeinu Shel Olam so that our lives are not a waste. You, in your compassion, have Rachmanis on us. Show us the grandeur of our neshama. Give us a glimpse into what it is that our neshamas can attain. Barachamecha, Rabbim, specifically with your compassion, because with our limited compassion, it still is so narrow. We got to take it a step further, and this is rather uncomfortable. And it's going to push buttons. So, just let's get the whole thing in. Everybody relax. After we go through it, we'll process it and put it in context. We need to process and apply to our own lives some of our own critical views. So, let's imagine for the moment, each of us has a picture of someone in our minds that we will apply this to, who we say about, or we think about, how foolish is this person who falls for the immediate gratification at the expense of the long-term well-being. So let's take something that everybody here will agree about. You take somebody who is addicted or tampers with drugs. Okay? Feels very good. I can't tell you this firsthand, But it's very clear from what people are doing and the amount of money that people are willing to pay for it that it is extremely, whatever word you want to use, it makes a person feel warm and fuzzy and elated and all these wonderful things. Let's give it for 4 hours. But they're going to end up burning a good portion of their brain cells. What's more is that it's addictive, and they're going to potentially destroy their lives. So what we say in our mind is, I acknowledge, I accept that it feels good, but that's very short-sighted. It is immature, and really, it's a person who completely lacks any type of vision. In fact, I would say that a good number of us have this very same claim against the yeshiva world. Because they are taking young people and are not giving them the tools to be able to establish responsible lives. They're looking now, right now, at using these years in the yeshiva where they should be spending some time building the building blocks that will allow these young people to provide for their families as they get older. How short-sighted is it of all those rabbis to inculcate these boys with an exclusive pursuit of Torah study where they're not preparing them for the long term? All of us have bumped into someone who has had a brush with cancer. And despite that, they continue to smoke. And we look at them and say, how stupid can somebody be to compromise their long-term well-being and not look at the ramifications of their actions? My kids are always amazed when we go walk by St. Joseph's Hospital, how many people are standing outside of the hospital and smoking. The kids are just, they can't believe, you know, that you're standing outside of a hospital. How could you not see what you're doing? Now, I'm not a mathematician, but I would like someone... I was going to sit down with Jerry Glazer actually and try figuring this out, what the numbers are. He could do this probably in 2 minutes. But let's take somebody with a long lifespan. Let's take a 100-year-old, okay? 4 hours of enjoyment of the drug addict. 4 hours on what's the best drug? Cocaine. Okay. Whatever it is. What's the most expensive drug? All right, let's say cocaine. 4 hours on cocaine compared to 100-year life, and let's say the person would only be compromising 80 years of those life, of that life. Okay, so you have 4 hours over or compared to 80 years. How does that compare to 1 minute for eternity? Good morning. Ratio-wise, we are all sitting in judgment and being severely critical of the drug addict who goes for the high of a few hours because they're going to be destroying life. They're going to be compromising the next 80 years of their life. And I ask you to ponder, is not an hour or a moment of eternity a greater loss than is the 4 hours of enjoyment compared to the 80 years? What am I saying? What I'm saying is as follows, is that we have the understanding that the time that we invest in Torah and mitzvahs doesn't get us, in the long term, 50, 60, 70 years, but it actually acquires for us eternity. Now, eternity, we're told, is a long time. So, we are critical of the yeshivas for not preparing our children to be able to provide for 60 years for their families. And what are we doing with our time? Is not a minute spent in the fulfillment of a mitzvah, in an act of kindness, in a moment of prayer, an investment in eternity, not manifold times longer than the 50, 60 years that we need to spend providing for family? Let's just apply our own criticism, our own critique of others, and apply it to our own belief system. Every one of us believes that there is a world of eternity, a world of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that goes on for all time. If we didn't believe it, we wouldn't be doing the things we're doing. And since we accept that, and it's all based upon the amount of investment we put into mitzvahs and into our serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so where do we stand in that very same critique? Are we perhaps being a little bit harsh on the drug addict, on the alcoholic? Let me build the structure. So, let's lay the foundation. The foundation is that investment across the board